Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to the third and final program in the life and times of 71-year-old Carol Cochrane. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and it's a real pleasure to bring you this program where we finish the story of Carol Cochrane. We've learnt that while being a football administrator in a junior league gave Carol much satisfaction, whereas both an instructor and a general dance demonstrator, that has given her not only a lot of satisfaction, but given her the opportunity to travel through Asia. In this program, Carol regales us with many tales, including one where she and the dance group had to bluff their way through customs in an Asian country without being checked so they wouldn't miss their train. Carol is a natural-born storyteller who holds nothing back, and she takes us through her final years of work where pizzas and pizza shop owners play a large part in the story. Great tales told well. So here is Carol talking about a Melbourne folklore character, Dickie Reardon.
The only thing we used to have to watch out for was the bikes that came out of Dickie Reardon's pub. Now, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but he's well gone, Dickie, so it's folklore of Richmond. Dickie was an SP bookmaker.
Oh, they were all over the place in those days.
Yeah, they were, that's true.
Every suburb had one.
And he used to have his look out it, and they used to come through the back gates. So we'd have to watch the cars that would come up the street and turn into the back gates to put their bet on or to buy their beer after hours.
That's right, on the sly.
Well, he was a sly grog dealer as well, Dickie. He was into everything. Got raided a few times, but the kids were at work. He's always knew, stay this side up. We never went past Mrs. Davison's, played our game from the light post. And one of our rules from Mum and Dad was when the street lights came home, everybody home, and we'd all be home for tea. Yeah. But we used to play, as I said, we'd play cricket, and then in summer it'd be footy. But we couldn't afford a football. Our way of having a football, we used to get the Age or the Sun or the Herald. We'd fold it up right down to a very small thing, wrap it up with rubber bands, and that was our football.
Yes.
So we used to, and I say to kids now, I used to play with the football, the paper football, and they look at you as if you're stupid.
Yeah.
And yet that was the we invented
about
things.
Imagination and,
exactly. We used the mind. We did things.
Yep.
We worked out. We'd play hopscotch in the street. We'd work out games that we could play. We'd play knuckles with the – we used to get the bones out of the Sunday lunch and we'd dry them out, clean them, and we'd play jacks with them. And these all these things we developed – by using our mind and our imagination. The kids don't do that nowadays.
No.
Unless it's given to them on a platter, they don't seem to have the ability of being able to work something out.
Which raises the issue of valuing things, doesn't it?
How it does.
When you've got to be inventive and create your own things, you learn to value things.
You did. You treasured things and you looked after them. And it was excitement when you got maybe you got a doll for Christmas. Like I used to give my doll to my brother and I'd play with his cars. That was well known, in fact, in our house.
That's your choice.
But, you know, like we'd get a little thing for Christmas and we were just so excited.
Sure.
Mum always made sure Father Christmas came. We had a sack we'd put out on the pillowcase in the end of the bed and come Christmas morning we'd wake up and the sack would be full. And because what my mum would do was she was a great one for the lay-by and dimmies. She'd go down there and she'd lay-by things all year for Christmas, and I don't know where she hid them, but we never found them. Believe me, we looked, we searched, don't know where she had them, but she managed to hide them from all us kids. And I know that one time, I suppose I got her trait because I do much the same thing, and I had one year that we were at home and I had all this stuff and for the kids, I'm Father Christmas here for this house, and we've still got White, he gets his Father Christmas sack. Anyway, I had one of my, the older boys, and he was a bit of a smarty. And he said to me, "I know your Father Christmas, you do it." And I said, "No, what are you talking about, telling a white lie? I know you've got it in your wardrobe," which I did have it in my wardrobe. And I thought, "Oh, God, what am I going to do?" So I quickly grabbed it all and shoved it in the car boot while he was at school. So when he came home, I said, "You reckon you I've got it in the wardrobe, do you?" "Yes, I know that all the presents are in the wardrobe." "So all right, show me." So he goes up to the wardrobe, throws it up and says, "They're not there. You're not Father Christmas." I said, "I told you I wasn't." I didn't fool till he was he believed.
Talk about so, boys. Did boys ever play a part in your life?
A little bit. I did sort of have a few romantic interests, but I never really was interested that much because I sort of had a family. And when I was 29, I took on the father role.
You did.
So I basically felt that I had my own family because, you know, then I was 14, 12, 9, and 8.
Yes,
so
indeed.
I sort of raised a family.
Now, you mentioned, though, that you managed to find time to do a bit of travelling.
Yes, I managed to go, did a couple of tours on the ships. I went to Asia, New Zealand, went on a tramp steamer to Japan. This is all through the dancing. And ended up in Hong Kong and all these places. And this was all done, we'd put on charity shows and the money, we wouldn't get any money ourselves, we'd pay our own way. They would provide our accommodation. That was the only thing that they did, and usually it was in the houses of the people. And all the money that was raised, and quite a fair bit, you'd be surprised at how popular it was, and particularly Asia, that we'd fill halls, auditoriums, and we had a three-hour show. So it wasn't just, you know, a bit of dancing. It would be, we used to do a bit of ballroom, a bit of Latin. We'd have the disco. We'd have the old time, as we used to call it. It's now called New Vogue. And we used to put on a show called Dancing Through the Ages. So we'd start off as cavemen. We go to the French minuet. We do a bit of village dancing, we'd have a polka, we'd have rock and roll. We had all the different styles through the years.
Yes.
And they loved it. And we'd have all the costumes, and here we are traipsing around all these country, you know, different countries, carting all this equipment. And we used to have hula hoops to make the minuet dresses. And I don't know how we ever got through the trains. I remember through the areas. Remember one time we were in I think it was Singapore, and we were going to get the train from Singapore to Kuala Lumpur. And it was really not a done thing for the white people to...
Roughly what years? I mean, how long...
Oh, gee, this was in the 60s. It was not done for the whites to, and particularly girls and ladies, to get on a train. Well, what happened was the bus didn't turn up. We're in the hotel, no transport. How are we going to get to the station? So we managed to call some taxis, and the taxis ferry us down, and we have to go through customs because we're going from one country to another. We have Joan in her fur coat. Everywhere we went, Joan wore this big, long fur mink coat, and she got us in the most amazing places we were never supposed to by walking up to them, flushing the coat open and saying, "Now, come on, follow me." We'd all follow on like ducks and get into the places we were not supposed to be because she bluffed the guards.
Yes, yes.
They think she's someone of authority.
Yes,
flushing
that's
the
right.
Badge.
Hey, you act like...
And all it was, it was our... We used to have a blazer with the Keith Collins dance logo on. So she'd flush the logo. And we'd get in. But anyway, getting back to this station, we've all got to go through customs. Train's going to pull out. We had about less than half an hour. We had to get us. There was 40 of us.
Mm, goodness me.
Had to get us on the train, through customs, onto the train, and we're travelling third class to make it even worse. And I'm not being racist or anything by saying it was the natives.
I know that. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
That's the way
whites did not travel.
They travelled first class. Well,
yes.
We were poor Australians who were paying our way that couldn't afford first class.
Yeah, but they don't understand that, do they?
No. Well, it was the funniest thing you've ever seen. Keith and Joan are there, and they go to customers and say, the rest of them, get going. And the whole line of us carrying our bags and everything straight through, past customs, the customs office, wait. We just kept going, couldn't understand anything. We don't speak English, we don't speak the language. throwing cases through windows of the train. God. The natives are hanging out, looking at us.
What the hell's going on?
What are these mad Australians doing? We're going through windows, through doors. Keith and Joan are quite calmly getting their luggage all checked. They come through. We're all on the train. It was a funny look. If we'd have stopped, and Keith said, "Don't you dare take photos."
No, don't stop. You know,
don't stop. Just keep going.
Yeah.
And we got on the train. They didn't find us. They just mad Australians.
Yeah, just easy to let it happen.
Yep.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Carol Cochran.
Do you have a favourite country?
I love Thailand. I really did. I love Thailand, the peace of the country. We had to go through the border where the fighting was on, and the train stopped before. We also travelled from Kuala Lumpur to Thailand by train. And I must admit, I did like Butterworth and the island of Penang. That was where the Butterworth was where the Army Air Force Base was. Mm. But we stayed on the island of Penang. That was lovely. We had to get the train again. We didn't have to, but we travelled that way. We got the train up to Bangkok, but the train had to stop before the border. Armed guards got on every carriage. We're carrying machine guns, and we think, what the heck's going on? And they had to take us through the bandit territory, and they escorted the train through, and that's right. The only way the trains got through.
Right.
So we ended up, we got through safely, you know, mad Australians. And, of course, they got used to us, the natives, you know. There's these mad Australians in amongst us, and we just sort of talk to them and eat the food. And every station you pulled up, the people would be there selling food, and then we'd be
the
just buying
carts, the
street carts,
yes.
Exactly. We'd be buying the food like the others. And I said, oh, well, they're just like one of us, and they accepted us. So, but when we got to Bangkok, it was quite funny. We had to dance in what was a nightclub. We didn't know this. And in the nightclub, they had the taxi girls. And they had, there's the board with all these numbers on it. And being curious, we asked, what's it for? Well, what it was, if the guy wanted to pick a certain girl, he'd come and he'd pick the number. And that was how the prostitutes would work.
Yes.
Well, we would be there and we'd have to do very quick changes. So no one had time to look at anyone. We'd be stripping clothes off. And, you know, like no bras, no, yeah. You know, just have a pair of knickers on. And the prostitutes are sitting there looking at us as if they're saying, why are you Australians? You're not ashamed of anything, you know. But we had no time to
think about it.
You just had to do it. It was instantaneous because,
yes.
You know, when you're doing this show of different dances, you're stripping out of one clothes and into the other as quick as you can because you've only had a few minutes, if anything. And, of course, you didn't even have time to think.
No.
This had all just happened.
Automatic, yeah.
And all the money that we raised, as I said, a lot of it went, it all went to the local charities to help the poor there. And it was all just...
So it's left you with lifelong memories, hasn't it? Wonderful memories.
Oh, it's left me with some lovely memories, you know. There's just so much of it, you know, of my travel and that. And I've done my travel. I don't want to go now. I've done it all. I don't think I could better
and in
experience
some ways,
I've
you
had.
Went maybe at the right time.
I did, when I was young enough to enjoy it.
And it was still a little bit like the Wild West out there, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, everything's very carefully planned these days.
Everything's planned these days, and you don't see what you want to see. Oh. We saw things that we shouldn't have seen.
Yeah.
We got up to Chiang Mai, and we saw all the drugs and the poppy fields and everything, and we don't see any of that now. It's all kept hidden. We went to New Zealand. That was our very first tour. That was the first experience we had of a tour. And we did the both islands. We stayed in Rotorua and, oh, the smell of the sulphur knocked us socks off. As you came over we're in the bus from the airport, and as you came over the hill, all of a sudden this most ghastly sulphur smell. I don't know how the people can live in it. I really don't. But it's a fascinating place with the hot springs and the ground all bubbling and all that. It really is fascinating country. And then you get down the South Island and it's all snow and everything. It's so totally different. We flew one way over to Wellington. Oh, it's the most frightening flight we've ever had. I've flown on a lot of planes, but this was a small one. And you'd be flying and then all of a sudden the plane would just drop and you'd be leaving your stomach up there. And one of the ladies that was with us, Mavis, she was petrified of flying. And Lenny, who's no longer with us, he went on to God a long time ago, he was sitting next to poor Mavis, poor Lenny. He had her fingernails embedded and the marks in his knee from where she grabbed every time the plane dropped. The poor boy was hobbling by the time he got off the thing. But it was such a lovely experience, and we made some fantastic friends. And actually, through Facebook, I managed to catch up with one.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yes, Ian's now. I'm caught up with Ian. He lives in Wonthaggi. He's up in travelling again. He's up in Queensland at the moment on holiday. But a friend of ours turned out that he's her grandfather.
Oh, there you
a
go.
A girl that one of my nephews went out with. Her grandfather, is it? And so it shows you what a small world it can be.
Yes, just a few degrees of separation.
Exactly, you know, and caught up with Jade, and she said to me, "You're talking about Ian Flanjaro?" And I said, "Yeah." "He's my grandfather." I said, "You've got to be kidding. He was my dance partner."
When did you finish work? When did you start
working? I finished work when I was 70. I actually retired.
Which is not that long ago.
No, it's not that long ago. I retired when I was in my 60s. And I drove myself crazy. I found my mind deteriorating and I thought, I can't stand this. And I've got to do something. You know, I can't retire.
What does somebody in their 60s find to do? Because the people keep saying it's hard.
When I was earning money early in my life, when I was dancing, I used to work in a pizza shop.
Right.
And I worked in this pizza shop and I would serve the cashier, and then I got bored with that and I kept nagging him and nagging him and nagging him. He says, "Let me make the pizzas. Let me learn. Let me learn." So he taught me. So I had that skill up my sleeve. And he also did pastas, so I learnt them. I was about 60 and I said, "Could do something." So I went back to Tony and I said, "Good job." And he said, "Yep." So I ended up becoming a pizza chef, making pizzas. And he had a place down in the city in Spencer Street. I worked down there for quite a while. And then he sold that, so I thought, oh, all right. And I'd gone up to Lilydale to Johnny Boy's up there, and I was working up there, and I met Henry. And when Johnny Boy's is a chain, and a young bloke comes in, he was an engineer at Kenworth. They made the Bedford trucks. And he wanted to become a pizza shop owner. So he came and learnt up there and I met John. So John then had the store down in Croydon and I gave up Lilydale and I went down to another store. And anyway, I happened to be working there and it was bought by Chinese. Now, I have nothing against Chinese. They're absolutely lovely people. Met a lot of them when I was travelling, but can't work for them.
Okay.
Yep. Can't work for a Jew either. I work for a Jew and they're the same. look, I had a beautiful Jewish boss. He passed away. The one who took over,
different.
Absolute nightmare. Mm. It was like working in Dickens times.
Yeah.
Seriously, it was. And I left for that reason. It really was. So, and there's beautiful Jewish people. So I'm not against them. I loved David, but the one who took over.
So that pushed you into permanent retirement?
Pushed me into the retirement. Yeah. And I gave it up. So anyway, I went back to this and I was working at this pizza shop and this Chinese bought it out from the bloke who was there and I thought, oh, I'll give it a while. And Ross had said to me, look, work with him. He doesn't know what was going on. He needs help, etc. So I kept working there and I was pretty well running the shop. I was doing all the ordering. I was making the pizzas, doing the pastas. But he had the most disgusting habits. We used to sell the raw prawns as part of a pizza. Now, they come in and bag frozen. Mm. You defrost as you go normally. Mm. He didn't believe in doing that. He wanted to defrost a dozen at a time. Now, if you didn't sell that pizza for a week, those things would be green.
Mm.
He would take them and he would want to wash them use them. I had a stand-up argument in the shop in front of a customer.
But that'd be against the
totally against everything.
Rules.
It was jeopardising my health certificate and everything that I had. I had all the food safety thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a stand-up argument where I refused point blank to use it. I picked them up, threw them in the bin. The customer stood up and he said, "Thank you for that." He said, "I'm glad somebody's got the morals and knows how to have good hygiene habits.
Could send the customers in the hospital.
Oh, I know. Could have killed them.
Yep, could have killed them.
Yep. And there was the shop next to us was bought out by Chinese. It was a fish and chip shop. They actually did put the customers in the hospital. Yep. Anyway, this particular shop didn't have a freezer or a cool room. It only had fridges. So at the end of the night, if there was any dough left over, we had to throw it out. You try and make enough so you'd work, but on a busy night, you might have a rack over. It'd be thrown out into the bin. Well, we were cleaning up, ready to go. One customer rings up and wants an order. We'd swept the floor, we cleaned the benches, all this is sitting on the dough. He went and picked it up out of the bin and was going to make the pizzas. I was nearly sick. I said to him, "That's it. I can't work here anymore. If you're having these habits, I'm out." I walked out, told the customer out in the street, "Don't even bother going in." I waited for the customer. "Don't even bother going in and getting the pizzas." I said, "They've been made from the floor," and went. And I went up to the shopping centre in Arndale Square, did some shopping because I was getting stuff for the kids' lunches, came out, and John was sitting. He owned the JJ's in Croydon in Arndale Square. He was sitting out there at the table having a coffee, saw me, called me over. "Oh, how are you? Haven't seen you for ages, since Lollydale, et cetera, et cetera. What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I've just walked out of where I was working." He said, "You're kidding." And I said, "No." I said, "I couldn't stand the hygiene habits." I said, "I will not work in a shop that wants to sell rotten stuff to customers. I will not put up with it. Won't do it. Against my principles." And John says, "Totally against mine." He said, "I need you." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm short-staffed." He said, "I need somebody. I need a pizza maker. I need a cook. He said, "Can you start?" I said, "Yeah, not doing anything. Haven't got another job." He said, "All right, tomorrow night, be here."
You've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time.
So I started working with him. He bought the shop up in Lilydale, which was Johnny Boy's that I'd used to work at. Asked some advice on it and asked me, did I think it'd go? And I said, yes. I said, it used to do great business. Unfortunately, the owner ran it right down. He had a marriage breakup, lost interest, everything went wrong. People stopped going. I said, I reckon we can build it back up again. I said, all we got to do is clean it up and clean up the act and get it working. Did that, ran the shop with the help of his nephew, did all the ordering, the usual thing that I do. And I was there for ages until I got an infection in my shoulder. And I was finished work on the Sunday night and was raced to hospital the Monday and ended up with septic arthritis, and that stopped me working.
Okay, so that brings about the end of your working career. And that's now right. Here you are sitting here in Yarra Junction.
I'm sitting here in Yarra Junction.
Quite a nice little view.
It is. It's a lovely view. We look out on the trees and the open air and it's lovely, and the dogs are busy having a sleep, the lazy two huskies we've got here.
So what do you see for your years to come? What would you like
dear
to
me.
Do?
Look, I'm quite happy here now. I don't think I want to go back to work. I've sort of got past that. I've just coming through having a knee reconstruction. And I'm happy here with the kids. The kids keep me occupied. Go out and do me a little bit of shopping. I've had my first expedition out to the shops yesterday. I drove the car, went down to Yarra Junction, got my hair cut. Didn't do any shopping because I was done by that stage. I know that sounds silly to say I was done, but having just been in hospital and sort of only just starting to walk a little bit well on the knee, to do that little bit of driving, that little bit of walking, that was enough.
Actually, your recovery is pretty good, isn't it? I mean,
it is, because the operation was only the 3rd of October, so they said that I was faster than they thought. I was up and walking the next day, and I was given a pair of crutches, and because of I broke my shoulder in March too, which didn't help matters, so I've got two bad shoulders. And I thought, now I'm not going to try and do what most people do, swing their body and support themselves through their arms. I'm going to find a different way of walking on the crutches. So I walked the crutches.
Yes.
I'd actually walk one as the leg would go out. I'd be holding the one that was matching. So I'd be walking the crutch with the moving leg. And the physio came to me and he says, you know, you're going home. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're using the crutches the way they're meant to be used. He said, everyone uses them wrong. Mm. They shouldn't be swinging their body. They should be walking them.
Yes.
So I was only in rehab for 4 days and they kicked me out. Had enough of me.
Well, if you're
so my aim is to get myself back up and walking. And we went out last Thursday night to my nephew's concert, and where I would be about 100 yards behind them all with my bad knees, I was 3 steps behind, and I was so proud of myself.
So you should be.
And that's my aim, is to get myself back and walking properly so I can go for a wander around this area.
Well, I have to say, Carol, if your spirit is any indication of where your body's going, you've got a lot of living still left to do.
Oh, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, I bet you are. Yep. Look, we can never get somebody's story, whole life, in such a short time, but I would like to thank you very much for sharing with us what you have shared. It's been a fascinating journey. I'm one that I think we could come back in another 15, 20 years' time and get some more of it.
You probably would.
Thank you for being on Listen to Older Voices.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.